This is Redbeard. Huey Thomason, the only member to appear on every Outlaws album, died at his home in Florida September 9, 2007. Huey, a chronic asthma sufferer, was only 55. This edition of In the Studio is in tribute to Huey Thomason. Hi, and welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard, with the stories behind history's greatest rock band.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
Today, in the studio, it's the best of Tampa Bay's guitar gunslingers, the Outlaws.
There goes another love song. Someone's singing about me again. The grass and high tides forever. Castles of stone, so glory.
Whatever it took to get to the gig is what we did, Red. We didn't care. We just wanted to play in front of people, and if it meant riding in the back of that truck, that's what we did.
Try and picture the Outlaws in a 1966 Chevrolet 12-foot panel truck with a cow skull stenciled on each side of the doors, and we would pull up to a job, and the sound man Rex usually drove, and he would jump out, untie the tailgate, and five or six people would pile out of the back of the truck, and that was us showing up at the gate, you know, at the gig.
Flashback, Henry.
Oh, it's really, really ugly, and but those were some of the best times. Yeah. Hi, I'm Henry Paul of the Outlaws.
And I'm Huey Thomason, and you're in the studio for the best of the Outlaws.
Like fellow Florida Brethren 38 Special, Tampa Bay's The Outlaws were second-generation Southern rockers who benefited from the trail blazed by two other bands from Gator Country. We're talking the Allman Brothers from Daytona Beach, and in particular, Lynyrd Skynyrd from Jacksonville. The Outlaws were formed in 1972 by singer-guitarist Huey Thomason and Henry Paul, bassist Frank O'Keefe, and drummer Monty Yoho, with guitarist Billy Jones added a year later. I joined Huey Thomason and Henry Paul in the studio. Henry Paul answers first. How did the two of you guys meet in Tampa?
I'd moved to New York and was working up there, and had put a band together and came down to Florida with it. And Monty Yoho, who had been playing with Huey, was available, and he had joined that group. And eventually the bass player from that group left, and we included Frank O'Keefe into the band. And when the band finally did break up, Huey had moved back to town, and he and Monty and Frank and I kind of formed a group, a four-piece group that would eventually become the Outlaws again. And Billy Jones was in Colorado playing in a band out there, and he moved home, and that was the original lineup from the recorded record standpoint. And we just went out and started playing clubs and really kind of paid our dues on a local and then a regional level, and eventually we met, you know, people like Ronnie Van Zant and people that would sing our praises and help us gain notoriety and recognition, and eventually that led to our record deal with Aristotle.
They also put us on shows with them, so we had a chance to be in front of a crowd and play our music for them too, so they were very helpful, all those guys.
Huey, what musical common ground did you find that you shared with Henry?
Our country influence. I was born in Virginia and lived there and grew up till I was about 10 or 11 years old. And my family did a lot of gospel and bluegrass music. And so when I was playing it younger, I really didn't care for it, but Mom said play it, so I did. Mm-hmm. And as I grew older and wiser, hopefully, I learned to appreciate what had happened to me when I was younger. So that's what we had in common to start with, and that helped form the sound of the band that you hear in the first two, three records. was a combination of the country influence and then, of course, our own original style thrown in with that, and the combination of me and Henry and then Frank and Billy, too. So I'd say the country influence was the most between Henry and I.
Sometimes I feel I am getting kind of low. Thoughts I am thinking are the reason. So I try to remember without talking to myself things that I've said or maybe things that I felt about you. Sitting in a corner of a crowded barroom, people all around me and I still feel alone. Just when I know I'm gonna break down and cry, someone play the tune that drives the tear from my eye.
There goes another love song, someone singing about me again. There goes another love song, now I need more than a friend.
Far from my home, trying to get back to where I know I belong. Wish and a hope that I was already there. I just heard a voice that whispered in my ear, singing,
there goes another love song, someone singing about me again. There goes another love song.
From the Outlaws' impressive debut in 1975, that's Huey Thomason singing lead on There Goes Another Love Song.
Huey, tell me about writing two songs that you recorded for your debut that, you know, we still play on the radio coast to coast and border to border to this day and probably always will. First of all, There Goes Another Love Song. Tell me about writing that one.
Well, actually, I had a partner, Monty Yoho, is a co-writer on that. And we were writing songs all along once we got together and started playing as a band. And we were in Georgia, I believe it was, Atlanta, Georgia, staying at 8 days in. We were playing and writing songs and doing gigs. And Monty came into my hotel room one day and said, I got it. And I asked him, I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, I got this chorus for a song. And so he sang it to me, and it was There Goes Another Love Song, you know, someone singing about me again. There goes another love song. Now I need more than a friend. I looked up and went, yeah, I like that, Monty. And so I took it from there and proceeded to you know, put some music to it. And we worked on it together and played it as a band. And the song developed into what you hear on the record today. So Monty actually started that song, and I finished it. And then the band put the icing on it, if you will.
I have never heard how Clive Davis, who had just left Columbia Records after signing Janis Joplin, Simon and Garfunkel, Santana, and Bruce Springsteen. Then he goes to start his own label, Arista. How he decided on a three lead guitar southern rock band from Tampa, Florida, to be his first signing. You got to tell me that story.
I think that, you know, the advent of Southern rock is a phenomenon. The Allman Brothers were on one label, Marshall Tucker being on that label, Leonard Skinner was on another label, and I think that they came and saw the band, they saw how, you know, professional we were with our performance and how energetic the band was and how, you know, we had musicianship and performing skills, and we really sold it live. We just were relentless in our pursuit of the audience's affection, and I think he sensed, you know, our potential, and given that Southern rock at that time was just emerging as a significant commercial musical entity, I think he wanted one of those for his stable. Being in the right place at the right time with the right kind of band was very instrumental in our signing, I think.
We had opened for Leonard Skinner. He came to see us. We had met Ronnie and the guys at Mother's in Nashville, played a show with them, and that's where we first met. And we jammed together the first time we met and played together and got to become friends. And so we were on the show playing with them when Clive came to see us. So we got to play in front of a Skinner crowd, open for Skinner, and, you know, Clive liked what he saw, like Henry said, and we went from there. So Ronnie actually did have something to do with it, because I ended up jamming with those guys. Henry, we all did we did tours with them, you know, up until the plane crash. And then, you know, everything changed after that, of course. But they were instrumental in helping us succeed in the music business, for sure.
How in the world did you get Doors legendary producer Paul Rothchild to agree to do a 3-lead guitar, no keyboard Southern rock band?
That was Clive. That was Clive Davis's doing. He matched us up with him. He thought he would be a good match for the band, and he was really dead on. And he also did our second record, Lady in Waiting, Paul Rothchild did as well.
Huey and I seemed to get the lion's share of the songwriting credits and lead vocal credits, but Billy Jones was a significant, how would I describe
Billy? Force within the band. I mean,
oh,
huge force. His harmonies and his melodies and his harmony guitar playing was just exceptional.
And his melodic
his
lead guitar playing was sensational. I remember going home and listening to the first album in an upscale stereo store, because none of us had a stereo at home worth a flip. And we all went down to this hoity-toity stereo shop, and they'd put our record on. We were just absolutely mind-blown by it, that we would sound that good, regardless of how good it was. I mean, that we could get to be, you know, we were just...
You could hold it in your hand and you could listen to it.
Awestruck by it.
As far as Greengrass and High Tides goes, that song took a couple of years to actually develop into what it ended up being on the record. We played it, and it was short to start with. It didn't have the long guitar solos at the end, and we just kept working on it, and the solos would get a little bit longer and a little bit longer, and, you know, eventually we found things that worked, and we got rid of the things that didn't, and as a matter of fact, a lot of the solos on that song ended up on the cutting room floor, if you will. That's what I was talking about earlier with Rothchild cutting tape and editing. I saw Greengrass laying all over the floor in the studio and went, oh, my God, my song is gone. Oh, and Paul's just very calmly going, you know, he's got it wrapped around his neck. It's laying on the floor. Pieces are laying over the chair. And he's keeping track of all of this in his mind. And we're sitting there going, what is he doing? He's cutting up the song that we just recorded. And when he put it back together and played it, there it was. So, I mean, it's he had a lot to do with that song in the end, too.
I also want to say that over the years, when we first started Greengrass and High Tides, it was like a 3.5-4 minute ballad. And we kept adding this outro onto it and this tempo change. And over the years in the clubs, we generated all these real cool little musical moves, mostly on the lead guitar part, but the band would follow it dynamically, where there'd be these giant dropouts of music and energy, and it would just suck the crowd into the band's music because it was so dynamic and so tight and rehearsed. And after Paul got done editing down the final version of the record, we literally had to go out and relearn it, you know, to kind of accommodate what we wound up with, because there were signature sections in the song, and we had to kind of go back and sort of rethink the wheel a little, because we had played it one way for so long, and then in a couple slices of the razor blade, we had another whole sort of arrangement on our hands. But it was very, concise, condensed, and
compressed,
and accurate from the standpoint of importance. So that was the long life and the many different phases of that song becoming an FM radio classic.
Place you only dream of, where your soul is always free. Silver stages, golden curtains filled by head plate as could be. As a rainbow grew around the sun, all my stars of love that died came from somewhere beyond the sea to see. These lovely people played just for me. If I bid you see this place where stories all ring true, will you let me past your face to see what's really you? It's not for me, I ask this question as though I were a king. For you have to love, believe, and feel before the burst of tambourines take you there. Green grass and high clouds forever. Castles of stone sold in glory. Lost faces said we adore you. As kings and queens bow and play for you.
Say we adore you as kings and queens.
an instant FM rock epic, the summer of 1975 from their first album. That's The Outlaws with Green Grass and High Tides. Next, The Outlaws aspired to combine that guitar firepower with storytelling and harmonies of the Eagles' classic Desperado. I'm Red Beard with Henry Paul and Huey Thomason in the studio for the best of The Outlaws. This is Red Beard. Huey Thomason, the only member to appear on every Outlaws album, died at his home in Florida September 9, 2007. Huey, a chronic asthma sufferer, was only 55. This edition of In the Studio is in tribute to Huey Thomason.
Hi, I'm Henry Paul of the Outlaws.
And I'm Huey Thomason, and you're in the studio for the best of the Outlaws.
And I'm Redbeard. Thanks, fellas. The Outlaws followed up their strong debut with Lady in Waiting, the album, in 1976. And though it received decent airplay, the band's Huey Thomason and Henry Paul remember lean times struggling just to make it to the next gig. Alive.
We rode around in what we call the copper coffin for a long time before we got a bus. It made things easier.
What was the copper coffin?
Oh, it was a van.
A Dodge maxi wagon with no interior.
And no side windows. And it was copper colored.
It was a bronze paint job. And what we did was we built a deck in the back, a plywood deck, and put a love seat between the deck and the front two seats. Oh,
yeah.
That was as wide as we could get in there. And so two people would ride in the front, two in the love seat. And inevitably, two people would be back there sleeping on the platform. It was ugly.
And we'd take turns driving, so we were in shifts at that point.
The copper coffin?
Yeah, that's what we called it. Well, we were praying that we didn't die in that thing is the reason we called it that, because we did a lot of traveling and actually put ourselves in harm's way, not really knowing it. Mm. Being the young and not so smart guys that we were then.
And I have to say that the Dodge maxi wagon was the step up. Before that, we rode in the back of our 12-foot equipment truck with the lift gate propped open by a gas can. We would sit in the back of that truck and ride around with the road manager or the sound man driving the truck, and we'd be four or five guys in the back and two in the front. It was nuts.
Whatever it took to get to the gig is what we did, Red. We didn't care. We just wanted to play in front of people, and if it meant riding in the back of that truck, that's what we did.
Try and picture this, if you can. Try and picture the Outlaws in a 1966 Chevrolet 12-foot panel truck with a cow skull stenciled on each side of the doors, and we would pull up to a job, and the sound man Rex usually drove, and he would jump out, untie the tailgate, and five or six people would pile out of the back of the truck, and that was us showing up at the gate, at the gig.
Flashback, Henry.
Oh, it's really, really ugly. But those were some of the best times.
That's Henry Paul singing Gunsmoke on the Outlaws' excellent third album, Hurry Sundown, produced by Eagles Hotel California producer Bill Zimzik.
Side one of the album Hurry Sundown has to be five of the finest songs back-to-back in Southern rock history, in my opinion, starting with your song, Henry, Gunsmoke. Tell me about writing Gunsmoke.
Well, by that time, we were, dabbling in the dark side. And
heavy rock.
we'd stay up late at night and with all kinds of energy that we couldn't really account for. And I remember one night I was having a hard time going to sleep. I was staying at the Essex House, which is a hoity-toity hotel in New York down on Central Park South. And I'm just kind of rolling around the bed, and I had this idea in my head, and the chorus came from it. And, you know, I've been singing that song here in the last year, and I have to say that's probably one of the best lyrics I've written. I really like the song, and Monty kind of tagged in with me a little bit on it as well, and he offered up a few ideas that helped me finish the song. And I don't know, for a group called the Outlaws, the theme Gunsmoke was appropriate, and I have to say for a few of the bands that came later in that genre, I saw a lot of imitation, which was flattering from the standpoint of subject matter. You know, you could see people were genuinely, they would gravitate towards songs that seemed to fit the band's image. And Hurry Sundown and Gunsmoke, I think, were significantly, well-suited for our group sound-wise and imagery-wise.
Huey, tell me the evolution of the song Hurry Sundown from its initial inception that you wrote to the final version that we all know.
Yeah, this is a good story.
That's funny.
I actually got the idea for writing the song to start with. I had the sound turned down on the TV one day, and there was a Western on I was watching, and I had my guitar in my hand, just sitting around. Not really trying to write a song or anything, just sitting there picking a little bit. And I looked up and I saw this gypsy girl, with a tambourine. She was dancing around the campfire and stuff. And so it gave me the idea for the song there. And when I wrote the song, the entire song was in double time, what you hear in the chorus. And when we took it to Bill, we got down there and started recording it. It was everything was the whole song. I mean,
Bill
started. Yeah, yeehaw is about right. And Bill kept scratching his head and going, I don't know. And so he came up with the idea of going to halftime for the verses, which changed the whole song completely and really brought it into what it ended up being. And so without him doing that, there's no telling what would have happened to that song. It would have been a barn stomper, I guess you would say. more like a water hole with words, But Bill straightened things out. He said, no, you need to go halftime in the verses, and we'll stay with your double time thing on the choruses. And so that's really kind of how it came to be.
Good.
title song to The Outlaws' 1977 thematic album Hurry Sundown, written and sung by Huey Thomason. Up next, The Outlaws confess to high crimes and misdemeanors, praise you, the fans, and saddle up for the final ride. I'm Redbeard with Henry Paul and Huey Thomason in the studio for the best of The Outlaws. This is Redbeard. Huey Thomason, the only member to appear on every Outlaws album, died at his home in Florida September 9, 2007. Huey, a chronic asthma sufferer, was only 55. This edition of In the Studio is in tribute to Huey Thomason.
Hi, I'm Henry Paul of the Outlaws.
And I'm Huey Thomason, and you're in the studio for the best of the Outlaws.
So, Henry, it begs the question, why then did you leave the Outlaws after just making, admittedly, your best album ever?
Well, that wasn't altogether my decision. I was,
There was turmoil within the band at that time. It wasn't totally all Henry's or all my fault. It was just we had come to musical parting of the ways, kind of, so to speak.
It had everything probably to do with control. I'm a very controlling kind of person, and I.
Me too. So, I mean, we'll tell the truth here. So.
Well, and Billy Jones, honestly, was involved in it. I mean, it really was the three of us, you know, just banging heads. And I thought, you know, I thought that the partnership, to a large degree, that we had started was a rather strong entity from the standpoint of commitment. But you know, the music business is a heartbreaking experience at times, and leaving the band for me was devastating. It was not to whine. It was just I had so much invested in it. It meant so much to me that, you know, leaving the group was just, you know, it just destroyed me. I remember sitting on my front porch with Billy and Monty and Huey and being the odd man out in the circumstances what they were at that time, and I have to say that for me, it was a two-edged sword. It really broke my heart in one way, but it really inspired me to move forward. And I was very proud, I have to say, in retrospect, of myself getting back up off the floor and forming the Henry Paul Band and going out and getting a new record deal. And it became sort of a hallmark of my career in the long run was that I was resourceful in reinventing myself and making those kinds of commitments that played out in a successful form and fashion from the Outlaws to the Henry Paul Band to the Outlaws to Black Hawk to the Outlaws, you know, just over and over again.
You said Outlaws three times.
But, you know, I mean, part of my beating, the bashing I gave myself, and part of the criticism that I was subject to back then, you know, I worked hard to overcome, and, you know, I got better as a singer, I got better as a songwriter, I got better as a
musician.
As a musician, yeah. and as a producer, and, you know, life is not a sprint, it's a distance race, but you know, I mean, I admire Huey. I'm a very, you know, I feel lucky to have been a witness to his immense talent. And it's not rhetoric and it's not wordplay. The guy was gifted and Billy was gifted. Frank, you know, Monty's commitment to the group and his dream was endearing. And after all the success and the miles on the road and the people and the audiences and the money and the drugs and the liquor, it just comes down to, you know, seeing it for what it was and recognizing what each and every one of us brought to the table. And I'm comfortable with my part in that.
Outlaws from 1978's Playin' to Win album, produced by superstar producer Mutt Lange.
There's some stuff in there that dogs and cats can hear.
Boy, you ain't kidding. And we should have changed the key before I sang that song. But we were a lot younger then. Our voices were higher, obviously, and your pants
were tighter.
Were tighter, of course, and we always had the vice grips on the side if we needed them. So we just got out there and sang it and layered it and sang it, and it was quite the chore to sing that song. It was a lot of work, and to get it right, it took a little while. We didn't just go out there and sing it, and that's one of the ones Mutt came down on us and said, you know, you want me to sing it? And I, if I remember correctly, he did sing on that song a little bit.
Wow.
Yeah, he sang on a couple of songs with us, but he didn't want any credit for it. And it's still up there right now. We haven't changed the key or anything. It's still difficult to sing, and you got to be dead on, or else it sounds, like you said, cats and dogs hear it.
Ghostwriters, who wrote it and who made it a hit way back when?
But I wanted to tell you first how it came that we did that song. We had gone to California with the producer Ron Nevison. And we were working on that record, and we were three quarters of the way through recording that album when Ron came to the band and said, look guys, we don't have the song.
Now, I'm sorry for interrupting, Huey, but when a producer or somebody in the biz says you don't have the song, what that's code
it
language.
It pissed me off.
No, but hold on. That's code language for what do they mean by that?
That means you don't have the right song for this record that's going to get you the airplay that you need.
You don't have a hit, right?
You don't have a hit.
Not
exactly.
Yet. Yeah, you don't have the hit song yet.
So what it did was it kind of upset all of us, and so we were all sitting around scratching our heads. And so I looked, I said, okay, well, so if we're going to do that, why don't we just record Ghost Riders? And Ron Nevison stood up and looked at all of us and said, that's the song.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. That's how that came to be. And then it took us about a week to record that song because of the arrangement. And we also had to do research to find out who wrote the song. And the man that wrote the song, his name was Stan Jones. He died in 1949, shortly after he wrote that song. And we went on to record the song and credited him with writing the song on our record, which no one had done after that. Everybody that had recorded that song, either, I'm not sure whether they used public domain or whether they used their own name, but he was the original writer. And so we set the record straight on that to start with. And then the song ended up taking us quite some time to record because of the arrangement, and we didn't want it to be just any old song. And Ron knew that. And so we went through a lot of work and a lot of sweat and a lot of studio time to get that song to where it was when it ended up being the finished product on the record.
Ghost Riders in the sky. Outlaws from 1980's Ghost Rider, updating the Outlaws saga, while Henry Paul resurfaced in 1994 to chart-topping contemporary country band Blackhawk. Huey Thomason later toured with the reformed Lynyrd Skynyrd Band, and he continued to lead the Outlaws. Sadly, Billy Jones and Frank O'Keefe each died within 3 weeks of one another in early 1985. Tragically, Huey Thomason passed away just last Sunday night, September 9th. Huey, a chronic asthma sufferer, was only 55. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking Henry Paul and the late Huey Thomason in what was his final national interview. Our condolences go out to the family and many, many friends of Huey Thomason. May God rest his soul. You can visit www.inthestudio.net for this and your other favorite interviews. In the Studio was written this edition by Redbeard, transcription Jane Carpenter, theme song by Andy Timmons. In the Studio is now in its 20th consecutive year, produced by Barbarossa Limited, copyright 2007. All rights reserved.